In Revelation 21, fascinating text that we want to talk about. Real quick, set the stage. Revelation 20 has been defined as the beginning in verse 11, the judgment scene. Now, we see that in Matthew 25 and a host of other passages. I was reading some material recently that reflected upon this text that we're going to study this morning, Revelation 21. And some of the material suggested some things that I really hadn't, I guess, completely thought about, that if indeed, and I have taken this position over the years, if indeed the late dating of the book is correct, then there would be no reason to suppose that these early Christians that we're seeing as members of the seven churches of Asia would not have access to other inspired writings such as 1 Corinthians, and 2 Corinthians that talk somewhat about the judgment, the book of Romans perhaps, the letters of Paul to those in Thessalonica that talks about the judgment. So the context of the latter part of the 20th chapter and on into the 21st chapter would be fitting with knowledge that they had previous from their acquaintance with these other books that we know as circulatory books that were circulated among the early churches. Now, having said that, you'll note the scene, and I think that's very important to the 21st chapter. Note the scene of verses 11 through verse 15 is a scene of judgment. Now, what has happened in that scene of judgment regarding death and Hades and the devil? What's happened to all of them? Randy?
Thrown in the lake of fire.
Thrown in the lake of fire. So what you see then beginning in chapter 21 follows that. Now, keep in mind, this is a picture scene that John is revealing for us, but it's after the judgment scene. Now we see in verse 1 of chapter 21, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth. What's happened to what was before? All gone. And included in that is the persecution of the saints in particular. Included in that is the war, as we saw beginning in chapter 12, between essentially good and evil, God and Satan, the Lamb and the devil, as it were. And so that's all past too. I think that is important for us to get the picture that's being presented in chapter 21. Because I now see, he says, a new heaven and a new earth, and the first heaven and the first earth are passed away, and the sea is no more. Now, we've talked about the sea, and I don't think that he's identifying simply a body of water. I think he's talking about that which distanced man from God. It is no more. Or the sea of humanity from which the evil things that had come upon the people of God originated. Rome in particular. This is no more. So this is all past. And then beginning in verse 2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And that's where I kind of want to pick up in our study. In our last study, we talked about this New Jerusalem, and we noted the language that as you would read from this language, if you were familiar with the Old Testament text, you would be familiar with the kind of language, a new heaven and a new earth. The old has passed away. And we saw that from the book of Isaiah, in particular, chapter 65, and a host of verses through that. And we noted that Isaiah's prophecy is messianic. He's pointing to the coming of Jesus. Now, having understood the use of that language, John is not pointing to a physical coming of Jesus. He's not coming to establish his kingdom. He's not talking about the establishment of the Lord's church or any such thing as that, as Isaiah was. But he is talking about a new order of things. The old heaven and the old earth has passed away, so now we've got a new order of things. And notice again, this is beyond the judgment that we read in chapter 20. Now, the devil is defeated. The new heaven and the new earth is going to be composed of everything that's clean. There won't be anything that's undefiled. It'll be a permanent dwelling place for those who have overcome the devil and those who worship and serve him. Now, that's the stage that we're seeing. Now, we've read and studied through the next several verses. I'll read those and conclude with verse 8 and then introduce verse 9. In verse 3, the text tells us, "And I heard a great voice out of the throne saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his peoples. And God himself shall be with them and be their God. And he shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more. The first things are passed away. And he that sitteth on the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And he saith, Write, for these words are faithful and true. And he saith unto me, They are come to pass. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto them that is athirst of the fountain of the water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit these things. And I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But for the fearful and unbelieving, and all and abominable, and murderers, and fornicators, and sorcerers, and idolaters, and all liars, their part shall be in the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death." Now, we've looked at the second death back over in the 20th chapter. Those who are victorious, they'll not be hurt by the second death. But these that are identified in verse 8, they will certainly be a part of the second death, which is identified as the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. Now, he comes back to a thought that's been introduced in verse 2. Now, in verse 9, he said, "And there came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls, who were laden with seven last plagues. And he spake with me, saying, Come hither, and I will show thee the bride, the wife of the Lamb." Now, that language we've already talked about. If you'll go back in the 19th chapter, we saw the great marriage supper there in verse 9 of chapter 19. And we also saw, by way of contrast, if you'll turn back to the 17th chapter, look at verse 1. Revelation 17, verse 1, regarding this angel that had the seven bowls. In verse 1 it says, "And there came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls, and spake with me, saying, Come hither, and I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth commit fornication, and they that dwell in the earth were made drunken with the wine of her fornication. And he carried me away by the Spirit into the wilderness, and I saw this woman sitting upon scarlet-colored beast," and so forth and so on. Now, what we want to note in that is in the 17th chapter, we're seeing this seventh angel. Do you see that in the text of the 17th chapter? And pronouncing judgment upon the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters. Who is that? Rome. Yeah, that's Rome. Now, if you'll drop down in that text, verse 15, it says, "And he saith unto me," this is chapter 17, verse 15, "The waters which thou sawest where the harlot sitteth are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues." So what we're looking at is that which was ruled by the empire. Now, this seventh angel that we're looking at over in the 21st chapter in verse 9 said, "Now come hither, and I will show thee the bride, the wife of the Lamb." Now, do you see a contrast here? In the 17th chapter, we saw the great harlot, Rome. We saw the destruction of the great harlot, Rome. Now the seventh angel that pronounced judgment upon Rome said, "I want to show you the bride of the Lamb." Now, if you can swing a pendulum from extreme to extreme, that's what we've done. That's what the Lord did in this chapter. He swung the pendulum from the great harlot, now all the way to the bride of the Lamb. And we see this described. And I think that's an impressive contrast, and we don't need to miss that. Randy?
Well, from a bird's eye view, it's the most grandiose kingdom men had ever had.
Oh, yeah.
To God's kingdom.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
What the pendulum is swinging.
That's it. And by way of comparison, there is no comparison. You know, as great as the kingdoms of men can be, can't compare to this. You see. And so now he shows us the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Now, before I click this button and go to the next chart, I want us to look back in our study to language that is not apocalyptic language, not signs and symbols, but passages that we're well familiar with, and that is in Ephesians chapter 5. In Ephesians chapter 5, you'll begin reading in the familiar text, verse 22. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 22. He says, "Wives, be in subjection unto your own husbands, as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, being himself the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for it, that he might sanctify it, having cleansed it by the washing of water with the word." Now here's where I want you to pay careful attention. "That he might present the church to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish." Now, when would that occur? When would the church be presented holy and without blemish? What we're reading here in Revelation 21:9. Here's the church now in its glorified state that John is privileged to see, as it's presented as the bride in the marriage feast of Revelation 19, verses 10, 8, 9, and 10. Perhaps on into verse 11. All right, I'm going to show you the bride. Here's the marriage feast. Now, while you have your Bible open there to Ephesians 5, let's not miss it. Read on in verse 28, he said, "Even so ought husbands also to love their own wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his own wife loveth himself, for no man ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as Christ also the church, because we are members of his body. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Now hold your finger there. What I want us to note just here is that the apostle has said a whole lot about marriage, hasn't he? He said a whole lot about the husband-wife relationship, and I frankly believe that in times gone by I've made this mistake. And that is, we read this text as if that's the thrust of what Paul is trying to communicate, the husband-wife relationship. No, there's a lot of information here, but it's used for the purpose of illustration. Don't miss that. What he says about the husband-wife relationship in all of its detail is used for the purpose of illustration. To illustrate what?
The relationship of Christ and the church.
That's exactly right. You'll notice in verse 32, he continues of Ephesians 5, "This mystery is great." What mystery is he talking about? The husband-wife relationship. That's a great thing. "But I speak in regard to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, do ye also severally love each one his own wife, even as himself, and let the wife see that she fear," or reverence, some translations say, "her husband." Now again, a lot of information is applicable to the husband-wife relationship, but when you study this passage, note that it's used for illustrative purposes to describe the relationship between Christ and the church. And in particular, for our point, in verse 27, that the church might be presented a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. Here is the bride of Christ being presented for the great marriage feast that we're studying about in Revelation 19 and now in 21. Now you'll note how that verse 9 comes back to verse 2 of Revelation 21. "Coming down out of heaven, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband." Now I'm going to show you the bride. Verse 9 of chapter 21. The bride of the Lamb. Now you contrast that with the great harlot of chapter 17. You've got something very, you use the word grandiosus, I believe. Yeah, that's what you've got here. You've got a great big thing. The pendulum has swung from extreme to extreme. Any comments or questions just there? What a grand image. All right, if you look at the next verse, he continues, "And he carried me away in the spirit to a mountain great and high, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God." Well, we saw that again in verse 2. The holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. And we want to talk about that just a little bit. Now keep in mind, who's doing the showing here? One of the seven angels, which has the vials of the last plague. Now we've talked about in chapter 1, I believe, where this imagery begins. John said, "I was taken up in the spirit." Now what does that mean? Same thing here. He's taken up in the Spirit. What's he describing? Carried me away in the Spirit to a mountain great and high. Where was John? He was on the Isle of Patmos. Yeah. Did he leave the Isle of Patmos in this vision? No, he's still on the Isle of Patmos. But the vision takes him up to a high mountain. Now, he's not on a high mountain, but that's where the vision, the perspective of the vision is revealed. Carried me away in the Spirit to a high mountain and showed me the holy city of Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. Now, some have raised a very interesting question. How can we have this holy city that essentially is heaven coming down out of heaven? I don't want us to get bogged down because we're looking at an image. He's showing him a picture. What's he showing him a picture of? The saints, the church, in their glorified state. So the point I think that's being established is really not that complicated. He's showing him that which is given by God. The reward to the saints. That's in contrast to what they've suffered, as you'll note, prior to verse 11 of chapter 20. All the way back to chapter 6, beginning in verse 9, when he talks about how long are we going to suffer like this, those souls that have been beheaded for the cause of Christ, calling out from under the altar. Now, it is a city descending from the presence of God in its glorified and holy or heavenly form. Now, look at its description. This becomes quite involved. If you'll note, beginning in verse 11, he said, having the glory of God, her light was like unto a stone most precious, as it were a jasper stone, clear as crystal, having a wall great and high, having 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. On the east were 3 gates, and on the north 3 gates, and on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he that spake with me had for a measure a golden reed to measure the city and the gates thereof and the wall thereof. Now, before we get into that measurement, I want to talk about what he's seen. I saw this city, and it had the glory of God. And you'll notice the description here of these precious stones, like jasper stones, clear as crystal. So we see the stones, and we see the great wall. And the great wall then begins to be described in considerable detail, not only here but later on. Considerable detail. Now, as you read concerning the description of this city, what could be some of the, I don't know how to term it. If you were going to describe some place that you would really like to be, how would you describe it?
The most rare and beautiful thing that you knew of.
Yeah. Now, some say, well, are we really talking about jasper stone and clear as crystal? I understand the color of jasper is not clear. So what are we talking about? Some say, well, it might be like a diamond. I know some scholars indicate that. I don't want us to become so bogged down on the specifics of the nature of these stones and the colors of them that we lose the symbol of how beautiful that it's described to be. He's not telling us that there are literal stones that are mined out of the hills or the quarry somewhere. But the most beautiful thing that you can imagine, this is what he's describing. And these saints had not experienced anything like that. Yes.
He goes on, I want to jump ahead, but just by way of illustration, what you're saying, over verse 21, it through the city was pure gold, like transparent glass.
Yeah.
Well, guess what?
Gold is not transparent.
Gold is not transparent.
Yeah.
And what does transparent glass look like? It looks like air.
Yeah.
You're looking through it.
Yeah.
Because it's transparent.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just, it's imagery to let you know that it's something that's very beautiful.
Yeah. And I think that's the point. We don't need to get bogged down in the specifics of the imagery. That this stone means this, and this stone means... No, we're not going to go there. We're just going to talk about it was a beautiful place. And this is what John is privileged to see. Now, another thing that I want us to concentrate on is in verse 12, the description of this wall. This wall is described, and we'll note the measurement a little bit later, as great and high. Now, when you consider the ancient world, even the city of Jerusalem, for that matter, the literal city of Jerusalem. Had Jerusalem been destroyed before? Oh, yeah. In fact, it had been destroyed a number of times. You'll note that it was destroyed by the king of Babylon. The temple and all that David built, the walls were in ruins. Remember, Nehemiah came and rebuilt, and Haggai, Zechariah came and rebuilt the temple and all of this. So what became the strength of any ancient city? Its walls. Its walls was its defense. And just so you know, I was doing some study of the ancient world and times gone by. And have you noticed that cities today don't have walls? You know why cities today don't have walls? What marked the end of the building of walls around cities?
Gunpowder.
Gunpowder. Yeah. What can you do with a wall today? Blow it up. So, in the ancient world, however, they'd throw rocks against it. And they'd just keep hammering it with catapults until they would break down the stone walls. But a wall, if it was big, high, thick, made it much more difficult to break down. We talk about the city of Jericho, and we notice that Rahab the harlot, her house was on top of the wall, which tells us that the wall was big and thick, but the walls collapsed. Every man went up straightway all the way around the city of Jericho because the people did what God said, and God gave Israel the city. So the walls of the city of Jericho didn't protect it, but that was the intent of a great and high wall around a city. That was its fortification. That was its protection. It was also its demise. When you read of the fall of the city of Jerusalem under the leadership of Titus, the Roman general, in 70 AD, one of the things I understand that was not uncommon to defeat the defense of a wall was not only to bombard the wall with stones thrown from a catapult, but even to throw diseased bodies over the wall into the city to infect the inhabitants of the city. Another thing that overcame a wall during those days was to put the army, your army, around the city so that none went out and none went in. Now, we know that was true during the conquering of the city by Titus in 70 AD. We know that happened in a very literal sense. He put his army around the city and just nobody was able to go in, go out. And so what happened then to the people? They starved to death. Yeah. Now, a wall is a good thing to keep the enemy on the outside, but it also keeps you on the inside. And if you don't have the sustenance that you need, you can't go outside the city to get it, you'll starve to death. Now, you infect the people with disease and infection by throwing dead bodies in. It don't take very long until things become very dire inside the city. But what we want to note concerning this new Jerusalem that's described here is its walls were great and high. What was going to happen to these walls? What's the image? Nothing. These walls won't be deteriorated. They won't be overthrown. Nothing's going to get over them. Nothing's going to get through them. And so these great and high walls would provide protection like the walls around ancient cities were intended to do, but they could not do to the nth degree. But this new Jerusalem would provide protection. You'll notice also, the writer goes on to say, verse 12, having a great and high wall, having 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and the names written thereon, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. And look, we'll read more of that as we go along. Some things we want to note just here. What's the significance, as we've studied, concerning the number 12?
It's a perfect number.
It is a perfect number. It indicates strength and power. And what we want to note about the number 12 is this wall had 12 gates, and it was protected by 12 angels at the gates. Now, when you go back, just do a little bit of research here. You go back, I believe it's to 2 Kings chapter 17, 18, and 19. You remember when the king of Assyria had threatened Hezekiah, that Hezekiah, you need to surrender because all the other cities round about and provinces round about, their kings were not able to deliver them. Their gods were not able to deliver them. So the city of Jerusalem is going to fall. And you remember Hezekiah said, no, sir, it won't. We're not going to surrender. And Hezekiah prayed to God. And in the morning, Richard, this is your cue. In the morning, God sent an angel in the night to the camp of the Assyrian soldiers. And in the morning, what happened?
They all woke up dead.
185,000 of them did. Now, I want you to note that here's what one angel can do. One angel, one night, killed 185,000 soldiers, armed soldiers. Now, what do you think 12 angels are going to do to protect the city of God? The point being is, the city of God is not going to be harmed. It provides the ultimate in protection. Now, we're not talking about literal physical protection, but there's the symbolism that we want to note. This city of redeemed people, they were permanent. They weren't going to be harmed. They were under the protecting hand of God. Not a physical city, not a literal city, but spiritual Jerusalem that God has blessed these people with. Now, another thing that I want to note in this, we've got 12 gates, and we see three on all four sides of this city that we sometimes sing the song, and from this text, city built four square. So we've got 12 gates, entrance into the city, indicating that folks can enter the city from any direction. The Apostle Peter described heaven in 2 Peter chapter 1, after the discussion, and just to note the context to familiarize you with what you already know. In chapter 1, he talks about the Christian graces or virtues, add to your faith virtue and so forth and so on, that there may be richly supplied unto you entrance into the eternal kingdom. That's in verse 11. So no matter where you are, from any direction, you can enter into this holy city. And I think that's the point that's being established here. And he indicates the names were written on the gates, and the names of the 12 tribes of Israel are specifically mentioned. What does that tell us? Who's going to inhabit this holy city? Somebody say, the Jews. We've got the Jews. No. No, what we want to note is what's said about those who were of Hebrew lineage who have been faithful. In Hebrews chapter 9, familiar text once again to you, beginning in verse 15. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 15. And for this cause he is the mediator of a new covenant, that a death having taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first covenant, that they that have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a testament is, there must of necessity be the death of him that made it. Now let's pause there. What do we know about those who lived under the first covenant? Who were faithful? Will they be a part of this holy city? Yeah, they'll be there. The redeeming blood of Christ, as we always look at Hebrews chapter 9, flows in both directions to take care of those who were faithful under the law, as well as those who are faithful under the terms of the new covenant. And you see that elaborated on in a host of other passages that we have on the board. So the faithful of the Old Testament times, they'll be a part of this heavenly Jerusalem. The faithful of the Lord's church will be a part of this heavenly Jerusalem, this holy city. And in verse 13, he continues, And says, on the east were three gates, and on the north three gates, and on the south three gates, and on the west three gates. I think we've covered that simply to indicate that entrance into this heavenly city can be gained from any direction. And then he begins to describe, and as we mentioned, some elaborate detail, the wall of the city. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now, when you look at any structure, what constitutes its strength? Its foundation. Its foundation. We see that in Matthew chapter 7. The wise man and the foolish man. The wise man heard the things that God said, and he did those things. And he's illustrated by the man who built his house upon the foundation. The foolish man is the man who built his house on the sand. He illustrates the man who heard what God said and didn't do it. So the strength of anything is determined by its foundation. And the foundation of this wall around this holy city, it says it had 12 foundations. And on them, 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Now I want us to note that when you begin to count those who served as apostles, your number exceeds 12, doesn't it? When you consider Matthias, you consider Paul. But the point is, here's our number 12 to indicate power and strength and completion. And when you read back in the text of the Ephesian letter, chapter 2 and on into chapter 3, we find that the message of the gospel is made known by the apostles and New Testament prophets. And so that's what we have in this passage. The wall of this city is established upon those things that were laid by the apostles of the Lamb. Here again, entrance from the city was available from any direction. And that's consistent with everything that we've read in the book of Revelation. Yes?
The Ephesians reference actually uses that same language.
Yes, it does. Ephesians 2 and 3.
Ephesians 2:20 says, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone.
Yes.
And the whole building being fit together is brought into the holy temple of the Lord.
And that context, let's not just focus on those verses, let's put it in that context. What's Paul discussing in the context of Ephesians 2? Who's the letter written to? And don't say the church in Ephesus. It's written to Jews and Gentiles who made up the church in Ephesus, to be specific. And so what we want to note is the Jews and Gentiles are builded together in one temple that become the habitation of God that's established upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets. Now that's the setting, and that's the wording of the passage that you noted. And so here's what we have that is alluded to in our text of Revelation 21. Okay? Any comments or questions? Isn't that exciting? To know that here's what these saints who were crying out from under the altar, now they see the defeat of Satan. That's all done. They see the defeat of the beast, the great harlot. They see that. That's all done. Judgment's taken place with them. And now the scene is presented, here's what's for you. Now, if you were suffering under that kind of persecution during New Testament time, would this be encouraging to you to know what you're waiting for? It's described in the only terms that you understand as the greatest thing that you can comprehend. And yes, such encouragement. Now, who gets to inhabit it? People from every kindred, tongue, people, and nation. As we look back in Revelation once again to the 5th chapter, verse 9. Now keep in mind the context of the 4th and 5th chapters, what's taking place there. The 4th and 5th chapters, what's John get to see? The throne room of God. And in the 4th chapter, he sees the 24 elders. No, the 24 creatures and the... I'm going to have to go look back at it.
Four
living creatures and 24 elders. Yes. And he sees them in the 4th chapter bowing down before God, saying in verse 8, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God, the Almighty, who was and who is to come." And you see the same thought presented in verse 11. But then the thought changes in chapter 5 for these living creatures and the elders are now singing praises unto the Lamb. he that sits on the throne. And in chapter 5, verse 9, and they sing a new song, saying, worthy art thou to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and didst purchase unto God with thy blood men of every tribe and tongue and people and nation, and madest them to be unto our God a kingdom and priests, and they reign upon the earth. What a marvelous picture. But it includes people of every tongue, creed, nation, language, people, and so forth and so on. In other words, Jews and Gentiles alike. And the gates of the ancient city, ancient cities were closed at night, you recall, to keep the enemy out. But now what's happened to the enemy here that we're reading about? They've been destroyed. Not going to be any enemy. So there's no reason to close the gates, is there? So the gates are forever open, because there is no enemy. So abundant entrance provided. Gates won't need to be shut. No enemies exist to invade the city.
So really, I mean, there's no reason for a wall either. But the image of having the high wall is just to invoke the eternal security of being a high wall.
It's a picture. Yeah, and we need to see it as that. It's a picture. You know, when we become literal in our thinking and think, well, you know, why do I have a wall? Why do we have a city that comes? You're missing the point. This is a picture of the grandeur of what God has provided for those who serve Him. Now, we've already noted, and you'll see it on the board, chapter 19, 20, and so forth, that, and most recently, chapter 21, verse 8, all of those things that present themselves as enemies of God, they've been cast into the lake of fire. It's over. So there is no enemy. The wall of the city had 12 foundations, one foundation for every gate, as it were. The 12 apostles, as we've talked about. And likely John would see his name there in this imagery. Now, look, if you will, at verse 21. I'm sorry, verse 15 of chapter 21. It says, and he that spake with me had for a measure a golden reed to measure the city and the gates thereof and the wall thereof. Now look carefully at this. This is just incredibly fascinating.
I'm sorry, but can you go back one slide? It seems like Judas Iscariot's name wouldn't be there.
No.
You know, the Holy Spirit chose Matthias to replace him.
True.
So it seems like if you're going by the, you know, the 12 chosen, that Matthias would be there instead.
I agree.
Just throw that in.
I agree. Don't have any quibble with that. So we're good. Now this measure, a golden reed to measure the city and to measure the gates of the wall, or to measure the gates and the wall thereof. And this is where we get the expression, the city lieth four square, and the length thereof is as great as the breadth. And the measured, he measured the city with the reed 12,000 furlongs. The length and the breadth and the height thereof are equal. Now, as you read these verses, you might begin to wonder, why the measurement? And why the size that is recorded? He measured, in verse 17, he measured the wall thereof 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of an angel. The building of the wall begins to give description regarding its appearance. But the measurement of it, again, we've got something that just kind of boggles your mind. Why a golden reed? Got a golden reed that's used as a measure. Well, again, it's imagery. What would be the most beautiful thing that you could use for such a measure? Well, we think gold is the most precious thing that there is.
The New American Standard says a gold measuring rod.
Yeah.
You're thinking if you're measuring a city that's 1,500 miles long, then that's a 1,500 mile long rod.
Yeah. And notice that we've got this thing that's square, city four square, but it's 1,500 miles long. Now, I want to ask you a question. Those of you who may be talking with folks who take a literal view of the book of Revelation. Everything's literal, and they've got some kind of futuristic view of the city, and it's going to be on Mount Zion in the literal city of Jerusalem. How big is the whole land of Palestine? Well, let's say, yeah, much. But you've got an average width of about 75 miles. Okay? The length from top to bottom is about 150 miles. But this city is described as 1,500 miles. Why, it won't even fit in the land of Palestine. Now, is he talking about something that's literal or not? It can't be.
In the translation I'm looking at, it's kind of unfortunate that they changed the unit because it loses the significance. Because in the American Standard, it talks about, so in verse 16, it's 12,000 furlongs, and there we have that 12 once again. And then in 17, the... because it measured the wall, I'm thinking, I don't know if they mean area, because then it says 144, which of course is 12 squared. I just taught that this week. Anyway, but it does lose a little something if the language is sort of antiquated, but if it's supposed to be 12 times 12, it's 144, and then it's got all these other units, that piece sort of gets lost.
Yes. Now, when you read this text and the measurement of the holy city, is there another Old Testament text that should come to your mind? Ezekiel measured the city. And you know the strange thing about Ezekiel's measuring the city? It won't fit on Zion either. It's way too big to fit on the land and the city of Jerusalem. It won't fit there. Now, how do we understand the language then of Ezekiel? It's the last couple of chapters, maybe three chapters.
So between the first and the last.
Well, yeah, but it's right at the tail end of the book of Ezekiel, and it's rather detailed, so I'll let you look it up. It's about three or four chapters long, just to describe the measurements. And when you boil it down, it won't fit in the city of Jerusalem. So the question is the city that Ezekiel is describing, is he describing a literal city? Well, no. No, and his measurements of the temple and all, it won't fit on the hill of Zion. Too big. Now, some have supposed, and I think perhaps one of the most logical explanations, he's describing the grandeur of the church. But be that as it may, when you read the measurements that somebody gives and you take, well, that's got to be literal. No, it won't even fit in the land of Palestine. How could it possibly be literal? The whole thing from top to bottom is about 150 miles, but you've got this city that's over 1,500 miles. How do you explain that?
And that's 1,500 miles.
Square.
Times 1,500 miles.
Yeah.
I think, too, so much detail, we can get lost in that. And to me, it just says, this is a prepared place, just like God said. It's all planned out.
Prepared for you from the foundation of the world, Matthew 25. Yeah. Exactly. And so I don't want us to get bogged down in that. I was talking with a fellow just down the street in the church building. And he had this image in his mind of what God is going to do in the future. And he'd studied the book of Revelation, taken all these numbers, and he'd multiplied and divided. He'd done a lot of math. That's fine, well and good, but he had a whole notebook full of figures. And he was trying to come up with a time when all this is going to be done. And I thought to myself, well, if you had spent just about half that much time studying what the Bible says instead of trying to mathematically inform yourself about when the second coming is going to be, you would have been far ahead, had much greater understanding of the Bible. Now all you've got is just a mass confusion because all these numbers and all this notebook means nothing. Just mass confusion to you. And he was. He was so mixed up, he didn't know which way was up. And you see why. And when you take a fellow that's been studying like that and he reads the Bible, what's ultimately he going to do with it? He just chunk the whole thing. Because it's not going to make sense to him. And that's what many have done. So, no, we're not talking about a literal measurement. We're simply talking about this, what I've called staggering dimension, to show that heaven will be so enormous that everybody that wants to go there can. There'll be room for those who are willing to obey the gospel and be faithful. The wall measured, as you mentioned, 144 cubits, and some have suggested, Carolyn, to your point, that we might not be necessarily talking about the height of the wall, but the thickness of the wall. But be that as it may, the idea is not necessarily a literal perception that we want to sometimes put on it. So we're talking about a place that is secure. We're talking about a place that is holy. We're talking about a place where God dwells with His people. That's a good place to stop right there at that point. All right. Thank you for your kind attention and participation in our study.